Hello, welcome everybody to the operating systems lecture, and this is going to be a grad course, so it's going to be, right? Okay, so you guys are interested in operating systems, or you are forced to take it because of the course requirement? Like, what's your motivation? I don't see many motivated faces here. So who is really motivated to take operating systems? Yeah, I want to do it. Only one.
Two.
Two. Okay, so the rest of them are like kind of forced by course requirement to take it, right? At least say yes, I'm not the professor, I'm just a TA. Okay, so professor is not here at Irvine, so he'll be starting the next class. So I'll touch upon a little bit of basics of operating systems and a little bit of C programming. I imagine that you guys are experts of C programming, being a grad student. So I will not go deep into C programming. And yeah, that's about it. So this is a grad course, so less than 100 students, so 97 to be precise. And your instructor is Anton Burtsev. You'll be seeing him in the next class. And our meeting time is, and we are two TAs TAing the class. One is myself, Vikram, and the other one is our architecture and operating systems expert, Janji. And we are yet to announce our office hours. So do you have any restrictions? Like, I heard MCS courses are scheduled in the later half of the day. So should it be like in the morning or in the afternoon, or should we set up a doodle?
So how many of you guys have class in the morning? And will you be here in the morning?
Probably,
yeah. All right.
Yeah. So maybe we will set up one in the morning and one in the afternoon so that you could like mix and match, right? And here's the web page, and there's a Piazza link. I think some of you have already enrolled on Piazza. Those are the interesting guys. I will note down their names. And there'll be a mailing list coming up, and office hours is set to be announced. Okay, so what about the course? It'll have 4 to 5 homeworks, starting from implementing a shell. That might be simple. We'll give you a framework. You have to like build on top of that. Or if you want to enjoy the core part of like creating something, you can even write your own shell. And these are the homeworks from the last quarter, so we might probably change it a little bit so that, right? And the slides will be posted online in the webpage. And the second homework is explaining what's on the stack, and the third one is like implementing a system call. If you want to have a detailed look into the homeworks, you could look into the previous web page that is linked in the current web page. And the grading is going to be curved, so don't worry. And the exams is going to be 40% of your weight, and where the midterm takes 15% and the final is 25% and the homeworks is 60%. And we will assign weights to the homeworks, like each homework carries a particular weight depending on the complexity of it. And you have a late submission policy? Yes! You can submit 3 days later than the deadline for 60% of your grade. So you'll have a multiplier of 0.6. So if you want to do it, please go ahead and do it.
And also the homeworks are not equally weighted. So depending on the difficulty, we might change the weights.
So whatever it is, you will get 60% of what you get, right? Okay, the course is inspired mainly by MIT's Operating System Engineering, which is slightly different course, which is like more practical oriented, where we use XP6. XP6 is a toy operating system built for teaching purposes by MIT professors. And it's pretty simple. It's just 9,000 lines of code. And it's a reasonably complete Unix kernel. So it is based out on early versions of Unix. And here's the link for XP6, and XP6 comes with a book which explains like the design of the x86 operating system, and also a source code printout, which is like 200 pages, right? So 200 pages of source code, you don't want to print it because the exam is going to be open book.
And open
you're not up. You're not happy with the open book exam? No happy faces for the open book exam? Okay, so the open book, no internet for the exams. You can use any resources that are given to you in the class, the notes that you take. You should not use Piazza, which is like searching for answers, right? You should not obviously use Google, because the last time we had a question on asking about what is the block number 49 of the file system doing, and one guy was typing block 49 XP6 right at Google, and he's looking for answers. So we are not that dumb to take answers directly from Google. So you don't expect any answers from Google, right? And the other reference is Operating System 3 Easy Pieces. This is a fun to read book by Ramsey. He's a great operating systems hacker. I think he's at Wisconsin Madison. And there's a free online version. You can just read it. It's quite easy. Like it's fun-filled operating system read. Okay, the course is organized as follows. Lectures, we will have high-level concepts and instructions, and we will also cover how an operating system concept is implemented in XV6 or in Unix or Linux kernel. And you will be given readings, background readings for that particular lecture. And that reading might contain pieces from the book as well as from the source code. And the homework is going to be like coding real parts of XV6 kernel. So you'll not be developing like massive amount of code, like 100 lines, maybe less than 100 lines. The last quarter, the total homeworks was like 250 lines of code. So more in the thinking part and less in the coding part. So you have to design something and then implement it. And you will have some design riddles like how we can speed up this, or how we can facilitate this, things like that. Or explaining parts of XV6, like why XV6 designs this particular thing in a different way, or why did they choose this design strategy. Okay, there comes the scary part, like solid C programming skills. Like how many of you know C? Like I know really C. Like I can rate myself out 8 out of 10 or 7 out of 10. Only one. At least 5 out of 10, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. So you know C or not? So? Okay. And since this is a graduate course, you will not be having a discussion session, right? You know that, right? So unlike the undergrad course where you have a dedicated discussion session, where we teach you, where we handhold you, where we spoon feed you on what you have to do, but here you're on your own, most likely. We will have office hours and professor will have office hours, but the rest is up to you. You have to be motivated to do this homework and attend the lectures and gain the understanding of the operating system and try to implement something for the homework. So XV6 is completely written in C with very few parts of assembly. You need to read the code which is on the book, as well as if you are interested to use any IDE, you can use that as well. You need to debug. When you write code, you have to debug to see if it works correctly. And yeah, all the homeworks are in C. We will not test you for assembly skills. And you should be able to work and code in Linux environment, like the command line interface or a makefile hacker, or automate things using a shell script, or quickly grep through the source code to find out which function is implemented where, right? And some bare minimal assembly skills to glue things together. And do you have any questions until this point? Like, I don't know C, I'm scared. Or will you be holding a C primer or C programming session?
How many of you know C++? And yeah, a lot of them.
And you obviously know that C is a subset of C++, so to speak, right? Okay. So, no questions until this point, like how, and we are not going to use any special resources for the class, like you can take handwritten notes or the slides will be posted online. And since this is an introductory lecture, we are not recording it, but the later lectures we will be recording it and the videos would be available online. And we'll make it easy for you guys. And what else? The homeworks will be rigorously checked for plagiarism, so don't do anything stupid. Sorry?
Can we have partners?
No, it's going to be individual. So even for the undergrad, it's going to be individual. So
there might be some extra credit opportunities for those homeworks.
Yeah, extra credit points would be given, like if you have more time and if you are smart enough, you can implement the extra credits. Any questions about the homeworks, about the lecture organization? Yes.
Yeah, they are not interrelated.
Yeah, the last quarter we had like not interrelated homework, so if you did not implement homework 2, you should be able to start homework 3. That's a good point. Next quarter we will implement that. Thanks for the idea. What else? Yes. No, you may need to understand assembly code for some very few pieces like context switches or interrupt handling or system calls. It's just for your own understanding. You don't need to be an expert of assembly to complete the homework. Any other questions? Okay, then let's start with C programming. Okay, so since you are already, like half of them are C++ programmers, I'm not gonna cover a very detailed C programming lecture. So it's gonna be like very basic stuff of what you have already known. And these pieces of code are from the XV6 book. So you could just relate it when you read the code. And you have conditionals, if else, constructs, and you have fork. Fork is for creating a new process. And you have the switch case. You guys are experts, so I'll skip this. And you have loops for while and do while. And again, these snippets are from the XV6 book. And you have functions in C, which are like subroutines to achieve something, right? For example, addition or subtraction, you write it in a subroutine and you call that. And you will have a calling convention. Say, for example, how do you pass arguments for the exec function? SH, argv, how is it passed on the stack? So you will study calling conventions in detail on how it is passed for a normal function call and for a system call. And we will get to know what a system call is. And file input and output, how to open files, close, how to read and write data from it. And I'm going to use a bit of whiteboard. Oops. Is this still visible? Okay, good. So then we have arrays, right? Arrays are a collection of objects of the same data type. Say I have int a of 10, which is like in memory, it would be like 0 to 9. If this is on a 32-bit system, this is going to be 4 byte wide, right? So a of 0 will give you the first element, and a of line will give you the last element. So it's a collection of objects of the same data type. And string, interestingly, is an array of characters. So in memory, it's going to be laid out like this, byte by byte. So is it still visible at the back, that corner? Thanks. So it's going to be H-E-L-L-O, followed by null character. And you can write the same using a character array as well. So this variable strA and str is going to be one and the same in the memory. And arrays have no reference operator. So if you want to get the address of A, you can either use A or ampersand A. It's going to point to the same thing. And you can verify it by printing just A and ampersand of A. As mentioned here, obviously address would be different in your system. Okay, is this clear, arrays? Because you're gonna be using a lot of it and a lot of array magics and structures as arrays. And array initialization So you can initialize an array using the corresponding index that you want to initialize, or using the designated initializer. Say, for example, you have like 256 elements, and you wanted to touch only a few elements. So either you can assign all of the other elements to zero, or set the memory of this whole A array to zero, or you can use designated initializers to be explicitly saying that here, hex 3A, hex 45, and hex 46 are initialized to the corresponding macros, caps lock, num lock, and scroll lock. So this is going to be more intuitive and more easy to like spot, like what's this piece of code doing. So this is equivalent to the below three lines of the code. If you want to write it in a C statement, it's going to be this way. And this is available in sheet 77 of your XP6 source code book. So I'll try to annotate every code piece to a corresponding sheet so that you could easily spot it. And arrays are elements of the same data type. And what if you have a record? Say, for example, the well-known example is student. I think you have been studying the struct student right from like sixth grade or seventh grade, right? Everyone writes struct student. So int roll number, char name, and so on. Like this is a collection of object of different data types. And obviously you can do, this is a custom data type, and obviously you can do all the operations that you can do on a normal data type. You can declare arrays of this type struct student, or you can declare a pointer of this type, right? Here, for example, we have a piece of code from homework one last year, and probably this year too. This is a data type of type integer, and what is this? Char star argv of, this is an array, right? So what is this? What is this whole thing? Pointer to an array, right? So it's equivalent to a double pointer. And you could use this struct exec command normally, like just a normal initialization, like normal declaration of the structure or a pointer declaration. So if you're going to use, if you're going to use the normal declaration, you access the members of the structure by E dot. And if you're using pointer, you use the arrow operator. Right. And if you use the arrow operator, the compiler, use the arrow or dot operator, the compiler knows the structure size or the structure arrangement, and it knows what offset to generate. Say, for example, if it's type, it's at the offset what? Yeah, it's at offset zero. So the compiler knows that when you say e.type, the compiler knows it's at offset zero. So it generates the corresponding code to access the memory from offset zero. And this would be at offset four, right, starting from four, because this occupies 0, 1, 2, and 3. So this starts from four. So the compiler knows how to generate offsets when you access structures. And next is type casting. Do you have any questions with related to, I mean, like, I think these are very, very basic stuff, right? You might have already seen in your previous classes, in your undergrad classes, right? Structures, arrays, unions. Unions, we are not covering it in much detail, which is more like you will get the size. Say, for example, if this is a union, and you will get the maximum size of, say, for example, this member one and member two. Your compiler will allocate the memory for this object, whichever object is of the maximum size. Like if M2 is greater than M1, it's going to be, the size is going to be M2. If M1 is greater than M2, the size is going to be M1. I think XP6 may use some unions, but with respect to the homeworks, we did not use unions, or we did not require you to use unions. Do you have any questions with respect to arrays or structures or anything in particular? Okay, then say I have an integer of 4 bytes, dead beef. This is a marker famously used in many file systems, or just as a marker to figure out the starting point of a memory address or something. And how do I get only the lower 2 bytes of this value? How can I get it? Like if you want to print the only the lower 2 bytes or lower 1 byte, Anybody? So how do I access this element, like EF? Say I want to print EF, or I want to access EF. Sorry?
Typecast to character pointer and then move appropriate type.
Yeah, you can typecast it to just a character, so that would just give us the lower 1 byte. So typecasting is conversion of one data type to another data type in order to access something in a different way. So the general typecasting thing is like you have the variable type, you have the variable, you have the destination type, and the destination type will be this, and this is the source variable. So here the source variable is A, and the destination type is char, and your destination variable and destination type. We'll be using a lot of typecasting in the XV6 code if you just browse through the code, because it's an easy way of fooling the compiler and achieve what we want. So the idea is to pass generic data types or objects. See here the struct command, which has just integer type, and struct exec command, which has integer type and some other element. And in these two functions, if you see in the exec command and run command, one guy typecasts the CMD to struct exec command pointer and tries to access the elements of it, and the other guy tries to generically typecast the exec command to command. So you can just, like, if you know what you're doing, you can just play around with the typecasting and pointers in C. Do you have any questions on typecasting? Okay, so if typecasting is converting a source variable from one type to another type, can you typecast this? I want to convert this into integer, so how do I do it? Wait. Just 238 in string. Can I typecast this directly to an integer to get 238? Yes? No? Not sure? Guys, this is an afternoon class. I know you are a bit sleepy or enjoying the rain. Be a little interactive so that we could enjoy the operating systems class. Yes, no, even if it's a no, it's fine. Or even if it's wrong, it's fine. Just be interactive. So can we typecast this 238 string to an integer by... Can we do this? Yes, no, you cannot do it?
No.
Why?
It's a character pointer.
Yeah, but our definition of typecasting says like you can convert from any type to any type, right? So is this a valid conversion? Like first, there are two things to it. Like one, this would compile. And second, it would not, run is not the right word. It would not give a meaningful representation of 238. Let's call it bogus. Like, will it compile? Yes, no?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, why does it compile? Why does it compile? Sorry?
because its value, it's a pointer, and it also has a value which could be an integer.
Mm-hmm.
It can be typecast into
integer. Good. Please be interactive, just like this. Yeah. So this is a valid conversion, but may or may not be the right conversion. This is a valid conversion because C is a loosely typed language. C doesn't check whether your source and destination types match. And that's why we do all these magics to play around with the pointers. And second, is it bogus or is it valid?
Bogus.
Why? So what will happen if you do this? What will, say for example, name is stored at, say like A1000 hex address, name is pointing to this. So what will num contain if you print it? What will num contain? So will it contain 238?
No.
So you are good at choose the best, right? So what will this contain? Like name? What will name contain? The address, right? Where is it pointing to? 8000. When you convert that into integer, it stays the same. So num will have the address of this name pointer. So how to do a valid conversion of a string to an integer? Sorry? Yeah. So you have to use dedicated functions like a to I or str to int in some languages, or str to l to ul. There are a lot of functions which tries to detect the ASCII and does the string to number conversion for you. So you have to use that. So you have to be aware of strings when you are typecasting. So you cannot just go around and typecast strings, right? And bit fields. This is a monster. So how many of you have heard of bit fields before? Anybody? Okay. So in operating systems, you are interacting with the hardware, basically, right? So you program the hardware to say, like, okay, I want this kind of functionality to be enabled or disabled. So the hardware is going to be restricted in memory, because for saving one bit information, like if it's either on or off, they are not going to waste a complete 4 byte. We have massive amounts of memory in terms of gigabytes. So we will say, like, okay, bool switch on is equal to true. So this is going to be integer in C++ or maybe a byte. I don't know, but it's definitely more than a bit, right? But we are not that much worried about the memory because we have huge amounts of RAM. But in the hardware, you're going to be restricted in terms of memory because the die space is going to blow up if you are using 4 bytes to store a 1 bit information. So you can store literally 32 switches like this if you're using bit fields. Suppose you wanted to say, like, okay, you define that the switch on is going to be 31st bit. So I'll say, like, okay, just turn this bit on or off to achieve the same functionality in hardware. So in hardware, I will just flip a bit and it does the magic. So we need bit fields in hardware because we need to conserve space. So this is an example of gate descriptor, which is a thing that needs to be programmed in the hardware on XV6. This is from XV6 again, from sheet 9, right? So here there are like fields listed. The first one is like of 16-bit wide, the first uint offset. And the second CS is 16-bit, and followed by like 5, 3, 4, 1, 2, 1, 16. So you can basically pack a structure as a series, as an elements, as a collection of elements of bit fields. And the sum would be like, how much is the sum? 64, okay. So you need to obviously pack this, because the compiler might introduce some packing elements in order to align this structure to a particular piece of memory. So if you want to make sure that this is going to be just 64 and not more than that, you need to pack the structure, which is a compiler directive, which says the compiler, I don't want any offset or padding elements in the structure, so you just pack as it is, even if it's not aligned at a particular offset. So if we have all these things, then we need a way to access a particular bit, right? So how do you access? You say, like, say, for example, if you want the S bit, which is like fourth from the bottom, to be on or off, you can just set it to D.S is equal to 0. If not, you have to do a lot of things. So this is the 64-bit data structure that was shown on the previous slide, laid out in memory. So here, the 44th bit. And if you are going to set this bit by not using the structure of bit fields, how do you do it? Say I want to set this 31st bit on this piece of memory. So how do you do it? Say this is stored in int A is this one, right? So A's memory layout is this, like 4 byte. And how do you set the 31st bit? So on a 4-byte data, what will be the 31st bit? Like, how do you represent this in hex? Say, for example, I need 1 followed by zeros until the 0th bit, right? So what is this in hex? This is simple, right? So you have a 4-byte data structure, and you set the 31st bit to 1. So what will be the hex representation of this? So how do you convert this number to hex? So it's going to be 8 followed by 7 zeros, right? But if you set this, you are erasing all the other bits, or you are resetting all the other bits to 0, right? Yeah. So what you basically do is, if you want to set a bit, you OR it with the previous data. Right? So how do you reset a bit? How do you reset? Say, for example, I want to say this is already set, and A is this one, and I want to make A, say, for example, this is already there. I want to make it like this. And with what? You know the AND logic, right? So if you AND it with this one, if AND it with zeros, all the other data is going to get vanished. What? Anybody from the back? Are you guys following? Is it really visible from the back, or? And that with? Someone said it, right? Ended with 7FF? Who said that? Okay. It's a good guess. So you and not, right? So you want to basically end it with this bit 0 and the rest of the bits as 1 so that you don't really corrupt the bit. So you use and not. And this would be heavily used inside the XP6 code to manipulate the bits of the hardware, right? So you should be clear on how you set or reset a bit. Not all data structures would be using the structure or bit field mechanisms. In assembly, if you want to do it, you have to do it this way. Is this clear on how you are going to set or reset a bit? And you can do all the operations in a similar way. Say, for example, if you want to XOR it, you can XOR it, right? That's fairly straightforward. And don't worry about the slides. Slides will be posted online. And in the kernel, you will have dynamic registration. You will see a lot of these things going on inside the kernel. What this piece of code is doing is it defines a structure called device and introduces two elements like read and write. And you know all the devices, all the I/O devices will have a read and write interface. Say for example keyboard. Keyboard will not have a write, will just have a read. And console. Console is the one that you will be operating on. So it will have a read and a write. So in order to make it generic for all the I/O devices, you will have a generic structure called dev software or dev SW, and it defines read and write. So all the devices can use this structure to register their functions. And if you see the below line, that's a global data structure that is an array of struct dev SW that has 10 elements. So this structure would be able to contain the function pointers of 10 different devices. So and that's a function pointer. Int star read is a function pointer. Function pointer points to a type, a function type. So just as integer pointer points to a data type of int, function pointer points to a function type of this signature, which returns an integer, which takes an inode pointer and a char pointer and an integer. And the registration would be like this. So the console write and read will have the same signature, which will have an inode pointer, char pointer, and an integer. And you will say, like, in the global data structure, I will update the console, the element that is meant for the console device driver, to have this console write and console read. So when you pack all these things on the global data structure, the kernel knows like what are the devices registered, and according to the index, say console has got an index of 1. So the kernel knows that it has to access element 1 to access the console read or write. So it does it magically. This is all clear. So this is from the background of structures and how compiler generates the offset of the structure, right? And an array initialization, right? These are all covered just right now, right? So is this all clear? If this is like, oh, this is crazy, I mean, like, this is gonna be This is how it's going to be when you look into the XP6 code, because it's a bare minimal operating system. It's a toy operating system for playing around with the operating system class, right? So it will not have fancy features. It will have very minimal features. And the design choices are made to keep it as simple as possible. So this is the simplistic design that you can think of for registering multiple devices or storing multiple device entries in a structure. If you look into the Linux kernel source code, you will have complicated stuff. like dynamic registration, allocating memory, moving pointers around, things like that. This is simple enough, right, to understand. And of course, you will have pointers, and we have already covered pointers a bit. And you will access raw memory, like for example, this 80000, that's the kernel base. So you don't worry about, if you don't understand what this code is doing, it's not no problem, it's fine, because this, we are not going to test for this understanding. This is just a sample snippet from the XV6 book so that you could connect yourself when you read the code. So if you don't understand what this is doing, just understand it in the C perspective. You don't need to necessarily understand in the operating system's perspective what this is being done, right? And that's a macro. That macro just adds an offset to the input element, right? Whatever you pass to A, it adds the kernel base to that element. Say, for example, here in the code, P2V0x7000, it just so this is what it's doing. And this is going to be a memory address, and the code would do something with this memory address. So inside the XV6 code base, you might see a lot of pieces of code like this, wherein you directly access the physical memory or the virtual memory, because in the kernel you have complete control, right? So you can do whatever you want. You don't have any restrictions. And for allocating memory, for dynamically allocating memory, so these are static allocations in A, right? And if you have a pointer to int B, where does it point to? If you just define a pointer int star B, where does it point to? In a C program. So what's inside B? Assume this is main. Since this is not pointing anywhere, this will contain garbage, some garbage, right? So you need to initialize this pointer to point to a valid location. So you say I have another integer which has a defined memory location, and I say like B is equal to the address of A. That's how you get a valid location at this address. So for integer, it is straightforward. You can assign an integer directly. But for complex data structures like structure, say, for example, I have a struct pointer here. Exec command. I can do this, but this defeats the purpose of having a pointer, right? So you want it to dynamically allocate memory. So how will you do it? So in normal programming interfaces, you will use malloc, right? Malloc or calloc. In XV6 code base, you use kalloc, which is kernel alloc, right? And you use functions like memset. And when you allocate a memory, you have to free it. When you're done, this prevents what? What if you don't free it? Memory leak, right? Okay. Looks like you're heating up. Good. And you use memcopy and memmove functions to copy memory around from one data structure to another. Okay, and this is the slight sneak peek into C programming. And I think this would be fairly enough to understand the XV6 code. If you have understood all the concepts covered here, it should be straightforward to read through the XV6 code and make something meaningful out of it. Do you have any questions related to C? And for debugging the code, we use GDB, which is the de facto debugger on Linux environments. And we used GDB init from this web page, which is like a customized version of GDB init, which gives you a list of registers and the flags on every step. You can use the normal GDB interface, or you can just copy this GDB init file to your default GDB init location to see what difference does it make. And there's a cheat sheet on the commands used for GDB at this address. You can download the PDF and play around with GDB. And you all have ICS accounts, right? So you will be programming your homeworks in Andromeda systems. You already have access to Andromeda, right? Good. We will be assigning systems because there are like 75 Andromeda machines, right? Yeah, 75 or something. So in order to distribute the load, we will be assigning you machines. It's not like a strict assignment. It's just to distribute the load. So if your roll number is like your roll number mod 75, you just like pick the machine you want, right? And you will have make files. Make files is just a build automation tool. Say you have a set of files, set of C files, set of source files, and you want to compile that into an executable or a library, you use make files. Make files is just an automation tool. You can even do it with hand, but it automates the things for you, like compiling it into object files according to the rules, or compiling it into just libraries or executables or whatever. Rules are written on plain text, and the rules will say like what you have to do with a particular file. Say you can say like for a C file, you compile that into an object file. For assembly, you invoke the assembler, things like that. And you don't need to be an expert of makefile. You will barely change a few lines of makefile in order to achieve something for your homeworks. But in order to understand the whole thing, like the whole build process of XP6, it would be good if you understand makefile in a more meaningful way, like what are those rules and how do they set a variable, how do they access. There are like, makefile itself is a language. It's like a scripting language. It has like all these conditional clauses like if, switch cases. I don't know about switch cases, but it definitely has if. It has loops as well. Loops not as in like do while, but it can iterate through a directory and get all the source files and compile that into an object file. Okay, and these are the tools that we'll be using for the homeworks so far. Are there any questions? Can we go into a little bit of operating system introduction? Looks like you're tired already. So you want me to go away and I'll ask the professor to come over here and then introduce you to the operating system world, if you want. The tutorial, maybe you can look at the slides or the discussion session videos that are posted online for the previous quarter, because we have covered this. All of the materials that I've covered so far, we have covered it in three discussion sessions, so it's going to be a three-hour material. So I'm just like condensing it to like 30 or 40 minute material for you. So you can look into the videos and the slides that are posted online. Yeah, for the previous quarter, the fall 17. I think the homepage has, as a previous quarter, linked to winter 17. I'll ask the professor to fix it. Or it's gonna be the thing. The last 238P, right? This is how we access it. So instead of that, it's 143A. So this is going to be fall 17's web link. So you can look at the discussion slides, discussion videos, homeworks, and the lectures as well. How much time do we have? 20 minutes. Good enough. Okay, any questions related to the material that we have covered so far, related to the homeworks or the course organization, Piazza? And Piazza, there's an anonymous feature as well, right? So please don't misuse it. Please use it to overcome your whatever. Okay, so what is the definition of operating system that you know of? Like, why do we need an operating system? Don't look into Wikipedia. I don't want a textbook definition. Like, I want your definition of operating system. Like, we all have mobile phones and watches, like smartwatches, right? Everything runs an operating system. So what is the purpose of an operating system? Louder, please.
Just to run all kinds of different applications.
Okay, different applications for different purposes. Run. Okay, this is a decent definition of an operating system, but different and different is a bit vague, right? So what different applications and for what different purposes are we running an operating system? Or what are the other definitions that you know of? Like, why do we need an operating system? You use phones day in and day out, right? So you must be knowing it. Hey, I got an iPhone update. Wow, it's so cool. How many of them are iPhone users? All of them. Apple fans. I should not bitch about Mac, right? Okay, what is the definition of operating system that you know of?
To make use of hardware efficiently.
Good. So to make efficient use of hardware. Okay, here these two terms need to be further defined. So what hardware are we talking about? So what do we have? Okay, so hardware, we have memory, right? Then CPU. Then devices. What does it contain? What is devices? Sorry? Keyboards. Okay. So input output devices like a monitor. Keyboard. Mouse. Etc. So and what do you mean by efficient use? So we have all these, right? So memory, CPU, devices, why can I not go ahead and use it? Definition. So it's an interface between user and the hardware. So here the hardware is no more vague because we have already defined what a hardware is. And the interface user can be tied to applications, right? So again, this doesn't clarify why we need efficient use of hardware, right? So it's an interface between user and the hardware, right? So but why do we need to use operating system or define operating system as an efficient use of hardware?
Because you're limited to reduce cost, limited power consumption, I guess the performance or whatever the limitations of the hardware is, you don't want it. There's no unlimited resources.
Very good. So we have a limited set of resources. Again, feel free to take pictures if you want, or you can even make handwritten notes. If you do take pictures, we can facilitate a Dropbox for the class, or you can post it on Piazza so that the other users can make use of it. Okay, we have a limited set of resources. What do we mean limited? We have limited memory. We have only one CPU. Assume a single core CPU, and we have only one devices. We don't have like hundreds of keyboards. We just have one keyboard with hundreds of keys. Right? We have only one mouse, one monitor. So the hardware resource is limited. So we want to make use of that hardware resource in an efficient way. So that's the definition of an operating system. So it's a layer of abstraction between the underlying hardware and the user or the applications, right? So what are the two main goals? One is to make efficient use of the hardware with a limited set of resources, right? So hardware OS is nothing but a resource virtualization. Virtualization is in the sense like we have only a limited set of resources, but the user need not necessarily know about it. The user would think that he has the entire set of hardware resources. So we will give an illusion of that to the end user or the end application. Similar, the same with memory. So the user does not know that it has only limited amounts of memory. It will think that it has all the memory of the whole system, and it will operate on that. And it's a resource manager. So it has to virtualize all these hardware resources, and it has to efficiently manage it. So that's the definition of an operating system, to make efficient use of the hardware with a limited set of resources. Any definition can be pointed back at the same thing, right? So use different applications, run different applications for different purposes, different applications in the sense like one wants to run a game, the other guy wants to run WhatsApp, so these are two different applications, and for two different purposes, and they make use of the hardware efficiently in such a way that the other guy doesn't know about the other guy. WhatsApp doesn't know about the game that you're playing, except that Google knows both, right? And it's an interface between user and the hardware, so it receives input from you, like the touch input or the keypad input, and it programs the hardware or gives feedback to the hardware. Say, for example, a capacitive touch gives feedback to the hardware, and it knows that you have touched a particular point or a particular pixel, right? That's the definition of operating system. So we have CPU virtualization. So we have only one CPU. Can I erase this? So you have only one CPU, and you have n different processes on your smartphone, right? You have like in the background apps, you have like tens and hundreds of applications running in the background and services connecting you to the Wi-Fi, to the Bluetooth, or pushing your audio stream or to the Bluetooth speaker, right? So all these processes needs to efficiently use the CPU. So how are we gonna do it? Or how this can be done, like in a layman way? So what's the basic idea behind like sharing the CPU? Like scheduling is still like more abstract way, like come a little bit close to the hardware. So how can we use this CPU? And what do we say, for example, we want to run process 0 and 1. So just take these two processes at first. We want to run only these two processes. So how do you do it? Someone said it, right? Alternate between these two. Like you run P0 for particular time, say 500 milliseconds. And you say like, okay, your time is over. So you give back the CPU. And run this for another 500 milliseconds. And say a 10 millisecond or 100 millisecond is for the switching delay. So it's like 495. Right? So in 1 second, you share the CPU between two processes. And what if you have n processes? You do the same thing, except that you cut down the time. So you time share the CPU between all the processes on the system and create an illusion to every process that it owns the CPU, right? And this switching has to be seamless. This process need not be aware that it got switched or it is sleeping, right? So that's why we need the kernel. Kernel is the master, that's the operating system, so that he manages the resources, he or she, right? To be politically correct. So the OS is the resource manager. It does the magic of switching between these two processes without the process even knowing about it, right? Each process has the entire CPU. You know, it's more like car rental. Say, for example, you rent a car and you give it back and the other guy takes it, right? And the guy number two is somehow dependent on you. If you delay the car, like if you delay giving back the car by 1 day, the other guy is going to suffer because you have only one car. On the multi-core machines, you have multiple CPUs. So the car rental company has grown. Now it has two CPUs, so two cars. So if you delay it somehow, the other guy will take this car, right? But so this is more like cooperative scheduling. This is called cooperative scheduling. So you use the resource only for a particular amount of time, and you give it back no matter what. So this doesn't always work. Like, what if a rogue application tries to use all the time and P1 does not get any time at all in the CPU? So this is cooperative scheduling. Scheduling is just a process of managing the CPU or creating an illusion of every process has the CPU on its own, right? And cooperative scheduling is the policy is kind of shifted back to the process, so you rely on the process to give it back to you so that you could schedule another process on the CPU. What if this guy turns rogue and he doesn't give back the CPU? So you have to do something, right? You have to do some policing. That's called preemptive. Scheduling. So you say, like, you've just got 500 milliseconds. And how do you do your preemptive scheduling? You make yourself the timer. And if the timer tick goes off, you say that the time is over for you. So you give back the car or the CPU because the other guy is waiting. So these are the two types of scheduling that we will see. Like, we will discuss this in a greater detail in the following lectures. And this is basically the time sharing of CPU, right? Do you have any questions on this? So, do you intuitively understand like how we are time sharing the CPU? You manage the resource by scheduling the processes on the CPU. And next comes the memory virtualization, because we have to virtualize all the hardware, right? Because we are limited on CPU, memory, and devices. So how memory can be virtualized? You have limited amount of memory, say like you have 128 megabytes of RAM. But every process has to run on this 128 megabytes. Like what is the simplistic design that you can come up with? And you can keep an upper bound of n is equal to 128 for the number of processes. So can you think of a simplistic design? Yeah. So the simplistic design would be like, you can say like, okay, I have an upper bound of 128 processes. So I will say like each process takes 1 MB of the RAM, and that's it. Problem is solved, right? So are we running phones or smartwatches like this? So what's the problem with this model? Sorry? So what's wrong with this design? Like we can easily say like 128 megabytes of memory can be chopped, just like time sharing of CPU. This is like equal splitting of the resource, right? Why is this not a good idea?
Allocation won't be proper if some process wants more memory.
Yeah, one problem is like if P0 wants like more memory, the allocation won't be proper. And if P1 wants like P1 is just using like 28 bytes. And this guy wants like 1,096 bytes, so which is more than 1 megabyte. And this guy is not even consuming like not even 10% of what he got, right? So there is a mismatch or not a perfect sharing of resource, right? This is one problem. And say we will somehow ask the process upfront on how much memory it wants. Would this solve the problem? So this guy says like I want 1,096. So this guy says I want 28. So you split the memory according to that. So you say like 1,096 followed by 28 bytes and followed by the other process's requirement. Would this solve the problem? Yes, no? Why? What?
It's easy to hijack the entire memory space, plus processes might not always know of their memory.
Yeah, process might not always know of the memory that they're going to use up front, because that's a restriction that you keep on the process. You cannot say like, hey, WhatsApp, you cannot use more than like 50 megabytes of memory. And what do you mean by hijacking?
Take the entire thing.
How can I take the entire thing?
Yeah,
the other problem is isolation. You don't have any check. You cannot prevent P0 from operating the entire memory. So there's no protection, right? There's literally no protection that any process can touch any other process's memory. So which is complete violation of the principles of design, right? If anybody can violate anyone's memory, there's no privacy. Yeah, you have seen the end of it, right? That's what you have been waiting for so long. So illusion is every process has its own memory. There's something, the concept is called virtual memory. So it's like having a deck of cards, like 52 cards, and you distribute it among four people. You just give them 13 cards, and the rest of the cards are just empty cards. If they access the empty card, you detect it dynamically, and then you say like, okay, I'll give you the real card. So that's the analogy of virtual memory. You'll see virtual memory in a great detail in the following lectures, but you should be easy to, it should be easy to understand, like, analogically, what are the concepts. But all of this would be covered in a greater detail in the future lectures. And similarly, devices needs to be virtualized as well, because you have only one keyboard and every process is waiting for the keyboard input. So you should know, like, from this keyboard, from this keystroke, like, which process gets this keystroke. And you say, like, you type something like, hey, I love you, honey. And you should not, you don't want that to be listened by Google or someone else. It should go to WhatsApp, right? So all these things needs to be virtualized, and that is done by device drivers. So all the devices would be managed by something called device drivers. It's just a magical term, but it's again a piece of software dedicated for maintaining the devices and the resources, like we have seen, the console read and console write, right? So similarly, every devices will have its read and write mechanism, and that's how we virtualize the device. And all of these would be covered in a greater detail. And thank you so much for your attention. And if you have any questions, I'll be here for another 10, 15 minutes.